discussing. That is, I had mentioned that what a normal Beis Din will generally do to ensure that whatever they decide will be obeyed and respected is they will ask the parties to sign a document designating the Beis Din as arbitrators. And as a result, a decision of a Beis Din will therefore be legally enforceable. And the prohibition that we discussed yesterday of not taking a Jew to court, the secular court, does not apply where the purpose of taking the Jewish person to court is to demand that he obey the decision of a Beis Din, if he doesn't otherwise do it. I should say, though, that on certain inyanim, this legal solution does not absolutely help. Let me give you a very common example. Let's say a husband and wife are going through a divorce proceeding. And obviously, there are many issues besides the divorce. There's an issue of who has custody of the children. How often will one parent who doesn't have custody be able to visit the children, have a connection to the children? There'll be an issue of child support and everything else. Now, according to Jewish law, a husband and a wife are obligated to have a Jewish Beis Din decide all of those questions. So if a person were to go to secular court instead of Jewish court to have those issues decided, they would be in transgression of the halacha, unless, of course, the other party refuses to go to a Beis Din. So let's say the parties go to a Jewish court, and the Beis Din discovers that the mother is not a Shomeres Shabbos, and because the mother is not a Shomeres Shabbos, they give primary custody to the husband over the wife. But the wife is not very happy with that, so she says, well, I'm going to go to secular court and have the judge give me custody, because usually a mother gets custody, and if the only reason I don't get custody is because I'm not religious, that makes no difference to a secular judge. Now here, even if they signed an arbitration agreement, legally it is not going to be binding on issues of children, because the reason is the following. The reason is that arbitration is generally not binding on matters concerning children, because the judge reserves for himself or herself the right to determine what's best for the kids. So it turns out the following. It turns out, therefore, if a Beis Din poskens a certain way, let's say against somebody, and that person would ask me, is this decision halakhically binding? The answer is yes. If they would ask me, is it legally binding? The answer would be no. Okay? Which means to say, if somebody doesn't care about halakha, they could really go to court, and there's no real way to ensure that the Beis Din's decision is going to be binding. Now, in Eretz Yisrael, this is largely not the case, because in Eretz Yisrael, under the secular law of the Knesset, although some people want to change that, matters of divorce and child custody are governed exclusively by the rabbinic courts and the halachic system. So you're not going to have in Eretz Yisrael a divergence between the halachic judgment and the secular judgment. But in other countries where you don't have that, that is going to be a problem. And there's no way a Beis Din can be sure that it's going to be listened to by an arbitration agreement, because the arbitration agreement might help a commercial dispute, or it might help a contract action, but it really wouldn't help the issues of child custody and the like. So that's something to be aware of, that there are certain limitations in Golos as to what a Beis Din is able to enforce. And child custody and visitation is one of those areas that a Beis Din cannot really enforce what they're doing. Of course, they can enforce it by excommunication, by cheirim, and by those things, but it cannot do it by having the parties sign an arbitration. So that's kind of the conclusion of our business ethics units, which we took a look at and took a little longer than I thought, but all right, that's for Seder. Yeah? Right. Well, it's a very good question. The reason is because there is a halacha in the Shulchan Aruch that a Jew is not allowed to sell non-kosher food. that's a din d'rabbanan. That's number, well, number one, you're causing other Jews to transgress the Torah. But even if you would limit your clientele to goyim, which isn't possible anyway, a Jew cannot be osek. A Jew cannot be involved in selling non-kosher. So the question becomes, does that apply even if the Jew is only a shareholder in a corporation that sells non-kosher food? And moreover, does it apply if he's a minority shareholder? Well, the analogy that comes to mind is this. We would treat a business selling non-kosher food similar to owning chametz during Pesach. Now, the halacha is, if you are a minority shareholder, if you only own a minority of shares in a business that sells chametz during Pesach, you are not obligated to sell your shares. So I would say that if you're a minority shareholder, there would not be a problem. If you are a majority shareholder or you control the affairs of the corporation, there might be a shayla there. Okay.
In cases, you say, where the decisions are not binding in terms of children,
yes.
Do judges in secular courts, do they just say, oh, well, these primitive-based ins, you know, they don't know what they're doing, or do they take that into account?
Okay, so that's very much, right. That very much depends on the relationship and the familiarity that the judges have with the quality of the Jewish rabbis in that particular locality. Meaning, legally, the judge does not have to pay any attention at all to what the Beis Din does, and it makes its own determination. However, if informally there has developed a relationship of trust over the years, then very often a judge will say, well, I'm not bound by what the Beis Din did, but nevertheless, I respect their judgment and I will use it. I'll give you an example of what happened in Maryland. In Maryland, in Baltimore at least, the rabbis and the judges had a very close relationship. So here's what happened. A Beis Din decided, after a very long and protracted controversial litigation, they decided that one parent deserved custody more than the other parent. The other parent didn't like that, so she went to secular courts to have it overturned. The judge wrote an opinion stating, I respect the judgment of the Beis Din, and therefore I affirm what the Beis Din decided. On appeal, the Supreme Court of Maryland, which is called the Court of Appeals, reversed the lower court judge by saying, hey, lower court judge, you're not allowed to just say you follow the Beis Din. You have to exercise your independent judgment on the matter. So what the judge did after this reversal was he simply wrote out the opinion of the Beis Din word for word. He didn't say, I follow the Beis Din. He said, my judgment is, and then he just had the whole decision. And that was a sustained appeal. Meaning to say that if the judge says, I am simply deferring to a Beis Din, that is reversible. But if the judge believes that he trusts the Beis Din, and therefore in his own judgment elects to follow them, that will often be good. But you see, it may depend on the issue, because I'll tell you why. It's one thing if a Beis Din determined that somebody is not a fit parent, so a judge might very well say, well, they know what they're doing, I respect them. But let's say the whole decision was based on religious grounds. Let's say the mother is fit, but she doesn't keep Shabbos, right? So there are things that a Beis Din may consider that a judge is not allowed to consider. And there, if the judge follows the Beis Din, that may be error, because he's taking a factor into account which legally is not relevant. So it may depend on the situation. There,
right.
The case I'm talking about, right?
Be a constitutional violation.
That's right. In the case I'm talking about, there were issues not just about religion. There were issues about who was the better parent. There was issues of abuse. So a judge could very well say, if he respects the Beis Din, as long as he doesn't say the words, I am following the Beis Din, as long as he says, I am exercising my own judgment on this, he could very well rubber stamp the Beis Din. And in many cities, the judges have respect, and they will follow it. On the other hand, when you have Beis Dins that say a mother doesn't get custody because she has a television or something like that, it's much less likely that judges will respect that, you know, kind of automatic thing, you know. Mother was seen wearing a shadow instead of, you know, whatever it is. Different issues. There might be issues which, to a particular cloistered type of Beis Din, would be very important, but would not really be important even in halacha so much, in Kal v'chomer and sacred law. Okay. All right. What I want to talk about now is really a totally new topic. So this is kind of a gemarnu, this, and you know that This week, this coming week, is Tu B'Shvat, 15th of Shvat, which is called Rosh Hashanah Li'ilanos. It is the New Year of Trees. And I thought we could spend one or two sessions talking about Judaism and the environments. Because Tu B'Shvat is a time, in fact, in Eretz Yisrael, not so much for the front, but for certainly the Chilonim, Tu B'Shvat is one of the most observed holidays. It's a little ironic that Tu B'Shvat might be observed more than some other Chagim. But nevertheless, it is kind of what is called the Jewish version of Arbor Day. And perhaps we could be mispainei, we could think about how I relate to the physical world that I live in. The truth of the matter is that the concept of our connection to nature is actually a very important aspect of Avodas Hashem that has become atrophied with the passage of time. If you look, for example, at the description of the Yomim Tovim, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos. So, of course, all of us know that Pesach is Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Exodus. Shavuos is Matan Torah, the receiving of the Torah. Sukkos commemorates the clouds of glory that accompanied us in our desert wanderings. That's very true. But if you look in the Chumash emphasizes other aspects of these Yom Tovim. And in fact, in the case of Shavuos, it doesn't even talk about Shavuos as Matan Torah. In fact, that's even covered up. It doesn't even say that in the Torah. But rather, the Torah emphasizes the Yom Tovim as part of an agricultural cycle. That Pesach is Chag HaAviv. Aviv means the beginning of spring after a long, dormant winter. Comes the spring and the first rising of the grains, and the barley, which ripens more quickly, is ready to be harvested. And then it comes Shavuos, which is the wheat harvest. And then comes Sukkos at the end of the summer and the beginning of the fall, in which all of the summer fruits that were left outside in the field to dry are ingathered into the home. That a human being would be inspired by the beginnings of growth and by the ripening and harvest and by the ingathering. And these particular events in the agricultural cycle are designed to inspire a person with feelings of hakaras hatov, and gratitude. And gratitude, right? This agricultural cycle. Now, the Maharal explains that these two aspects of the holidays, in other words, the spiritual events, right? Yetzias Mitzrayim, Matan Torah, and clouds of glory, actually match up the physical thing of Aviv, spring, Katsir, harvest, and Asif, ingathering. Because basically, everything physical that happens in the world is reflective of the spiritual realities that are taking place at that very time. Meaning, for example, we see this. Now, the Torah is very, very insistent that Pesach be celebrated in the spring. The Torah says explicitly, Pesach must be celebrated in the spring. How could Pesach not be celebrated in the spring? Well, without an adjustment, it wouldn't be celebrated in the spring, because we know that the Jewish calendar is a lunar calendar. It is based on the moon. That itself has very deep significance. It's 12 lunar revolutions equals a year. 12 lunar revolutions is 354 days. A solar year, which is the revolution of the Earth around the Sun, looks like the Sun around the Earth, is 365 and a fourth, approximately a fourth days. That means a lunar year is 11 days shorter than a solar year. Now, the seasons are based on the position of the Sun around the Earth. Not the Earth around the Sun, but we talk about the Sun around the Earth. So what's going to happen is this. This is what happens in Ramadan, because the Islamic calendar is purely lunar. So Ramadan begins 11 days earlier every year. So if this year it begins, let's say, in March, then next year will begin February, then January. So in other words, it can begin any time in the year. Now, what's going to happen is, let's assume that Pesach on one year is April 15. Next year it'll be April 4th. Next year it'll be the end of March. The year after, the middle of March. Eventually February, eventually January. But that's not a shayach, because the Torah requires that Pesach be in the spring. So to ensure that you're never too far behind the solar calendar. So as you know, in 7 out of 19 years, this is how the calendar is worked out, we add an extra month of Adar. which is called Adar Sheni, because that assumes that when Pesach is getting too early, we add a month that pushes Pesach in order to fulfill the idea of Chodesh Aviv, that Pesach must be in the spring. Now, here's the point. Of course, that doesn't help with the southern hemisphere, like Australia and everything else. That is a problem. But the holiness of the holidays is based on the cycle of Eretz Yisrael. Okay, not the rest of the world. Now, here's the thing. If climate and environment are inconsequential matters, then, like, you know, if the main thing is to celebrate the exodus of Egypt, then who cares if it's winter, spring, summer, fall? Why would there be such a hakpada? Why would there be such an insistence to keep it in the spring? So the Maharal explains very simply. Because the concept is, what goes on in the physical is reflective of the spiritual. The fact that during the spring, the plants, which as it were imprisoned during the winter, can finally come out, is because in the air there is the freedom that liberates you from enslavement. So if I were to make Pesach at a time when that phenomenon is not occurring, the vibrations of freedom wouldn't be there. Remember, and of course we know that the notion of Pesach as a time of Yetzias Mitzrayim also means it's a time when Hashem gives us the capacity to become free from whatever it is that enslaves us. Our anger, our arrogance, our gaiva, our materialism. But that's only because this is the Zman Cheruseinu, the Zman of freedom. But the Zman of freedom is reflected in what the earth is doing. See what the Maharal is saying? So there has to be a shidduch. There has to be a union between what is going on in the earth and what is going on spiritually, because the earth is just a reflection of those spiritual forces. So the agricultural cycle, right? The spring is the liberation from the dormant winter, and then we have Shavuos, which is Kotzer, that's the harvest, and that's Matan Torah, because the harvest is when you're ready to have the grain, you're ready to have the knowledge that will give you the ability to, in other words, liberation is coming up from the earth. That's spring. Harvest is when you have a finished product that will give you nutrition. That's the Torah. And Asif, in gathering, is when you can take it into your house, and that corresponds to Sukkos, when you can take God's teachings into your heart and soul because you've been through the purity of Yom Kippur. Okay? So the physical and the spiritual are two complementary ideas. So the whole pilgrimage festivals were set up based on agricultural assumption to be aware of the cycles and everything else. In fact, we find that Chazal give, you know, we have six orders of the Mishnah. And the first order of the Mishnah is Seder Zerayim, that deals with all the agricultural laws, such which are mainly in Eretz Yisrael, such as Truma and Maser, right, the tithing and the observance of Shemitah and everything else. Now, Chazal gave every order of the Mishnah a nickname based on a pasuk. In other words, Seder Zerayim, which is its real name, is also called Seder Emuna, the Seder of faith. Why is Zerayim faith? Because although all Parnassah comes from Hashem, but the farmer realizes it more than others. Because there is so much that is outside the farmer's hands. Right? The farmer can plant, but the farmer needs the rain. If the rain doesn't come or there's not enough light, it's not going to work. So Zerayim is an affirmation. Agriculture is said to be an affirmation of our dependence on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it gives a person a very, very deep sense of emunah. So thus, when we talk about the idea of being sensitive to the environment, it's really very much implicit in the whole Shalosh Regalim and everything else. Now, when we say Tu B'Shvat, the 15th of Shvat, is Rosh Hashanah Le'ilonos. What does that mean? It is the new year for trees. Where is that phrase taken from? That is taken from a Mishnah at the beginning of Maseches Rosh Hashanah, tractate Rosh Hashanah, that in fact says there are 4 days in the Jewish calendar that are called New Year. There is Rosh Chodesh Nisan, it's called a New Year for some purposes. There is Rosh Chodesh Tishrei, which is, of course, that's the big Rosh Hashanah. There's Rosh Chodesh Elul, and then, according to Beit Shammai, there is Rosh Chodesh Shabbat. According to Beis Hillel, it is the 15th of Shabbat, which is called Rosh Hashanah for trees. Now, here's the question. What does the Mishnah mean by the phrase Rosh Hashanah for trees? So the truth of the matter is, the Mishnah does not mean very much. Meaning to say, the Mishnah is not suggesting at all that Tu B'Shvat is some type of holiday. Rather, it's a very narrow halachic technical idea, which is still very relevant here. Let me explain the halachic background, and then we'll see how Tu B'Shvat developed after the Mekubalim into a much bigger thing. We know that the agricultural cycle in the land of Israel is divided into 7 years. Every seventh year is a Shemitah year. Shemitah we don't plant. Okay, so we really have years 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. If I'm a Jewish farmer, every single year I have to separate 2% of my crop and give it to a Kohen. That's called Truma. That's every year. Moreover, every single year I separate 10% of my crop and give it to a Levi. Today we don't give it because people are Tamei, etc. The time of the Beis Hamikdash, let's assume. So that's called Maser Rishon, the first tithe. Okay, so every single year, you separate 2% of Truma, give it to the Kohen. Every single year, 10% of your crop, that's given to a Levi. That's called Maser Rishon. And the Levi, in turn, is supposed to take 10% of that and give it to the Kohen. That's called the Truma that comes from the Maser. Okay. All right, so that's constant for all the years. However, there is a second tithe, a second 10%, that is supposed to be separated every year, but what that is varies from year to year. In year one of the cycle, in year two of the cycle, in year four and year five, 1, 2, 4, and 5, the second tithe is taken to the city of Jerusalem, the old city as it would be, and it is eaten. You eat it with your family. You don't give it away. You eat it with your family. That is called Maaser Sheni, the second tithe. In year 3 and year 6, a second tithe is separated, but instead of eating it in Yerushalayim, it is distributed to the poor. And that is called Maaser Ani. Okay, so again, just one year, 10% given to the Levi, that is called Maaser Rishon, the first tithe. In year 1, 2, 4, and 5 of the cycle, a second tithe is separated and it's brought to Yerushalayim and it's eaten by the family. In year 3 and 6, in lieu of a tithe that is taken to Yerushalayim, the produce, 10% of the produce, is distributed to the poor. Now, this is in addition to taking tzedakah from your income, my maaser from your income. In other words, don't confuse the maaser ani, which is giving 10% of your crop to the poor, which only applies the third and the sixth year of the Shemitah cycle, with the obligation of always giving 10% of your income to the poor. That's a separate thing. Now, what about the seventh year? Well, the seventh year, you don't plant any crops. The seventh year is Shemitah. And even if crops grow of their own accord, which you're allowed to harvest, if there's a tree, you're allowed to eat three, but Shemitah, you are exempt from any tithing. Shemitah fruits, one does not take off the Truma or the Maaser. The reason is very simple. Because all Shemitah fruit is Hefker. Hefker meaning, in other words, if you have a tree in your yard that's growing fruit on Shemitah, I can go pick it without your permission. So consequently, there's no concept of separating something for the calling of the Levi, because anybody who wants can come in and take. Okay. Now, alright, so that's one thing about the calendar. Now, you'll see why Tu B'Shvat is important. Now,
yeah. You end up giving away about 10% from the 12% from the land and 10% from the total possession of the year.
Well, it's not quite that way, because these things are declining, meaning to say the Truma is 2% of the original. Let's say you have 100 bushels. So the Truma says you give away 2 bushels, which is 2%. Okay, now the Maaser is 10% of 98 bushels. So the 10% of the 98 bushels is 9.8 bushels. Now if you subtract 9.8 minus 98 and you're given a figure, the Maaser Sheni is 10% of that figure. So it's close. It's around 16 or 17% is what you're giving away. Of course, Masa Sheni, you're not giving it away. Masa Sheni is for you to eat, except you go to Yerushalayim and you eat it with Kedusha. Now, I don't want to explain that. I mean, it would be a little complicated at this juncture to explain how come we don't do all of that today. The answer is we do do some of that today. We don't actually give truma to a kohen, because truma can only be eaten when the kohen is tahor, ritually pure. And we also separate various tithes, but generally speaking, this is either done by the store, right? That's why Eretz Yisrael, kashrus is a bigger problem than in America. In the United States, I know, right, people always say, well, you can always buy fruit somewhere, right? Buy fruit. In Eretz Yisrael, even the fruit is a question, because until the proper tithing was done, which you can do yourself if you know how to do it, but generally speaking, if you're not familiar, you have to go to a store that has supervision on the fruit, you do have a halachic problem. You cannot eat an apple in Eretz Yisrael unless you know that the trumas and the masros were properly taken off. So, in a way, the kashrus problems here are greater than they would be in chutz la'aretz.
What do they do when they take it off?
Now, what they generally do is they throw it away, basically. It's wrapped in plastic and it's thrown away. So, except for the Maserani, the only thing is that the farmers, the tithing that would go to the poor, does go to the poor, that much is so. But everything else, you know, the Maser Sheni and the like, well, the Maser Sheni is another thing. You could redeem that on a coin. So that could be redeemed on a coin and then it goes back into the pile. But some of it, a certain percentage of the crop must be thrown away, because that is in lieu of the tithing that would have to be done.
And would they be lawfully just to give the that stuff that they're throwing away, give it to poor people, and they can't do that?
No, you can't. It has holiness. And because it's holy and nobody can eat it, you can't feed it to animals. It has to be thrown away. Yeah. It's wrapped in plastic and it's thrown away.
I'm living with a religious family over here, right. And we brought home some potatoes and beets.
Right.
She wasn't sure of the place when we bought it, yeah. So she cut out a little section.
That's right. It's kind of paradoxical, I understand, that there's something that's so holy, it can only go into the garbage. But indeed. Now, you don't throw it directly. I mean, you wrap it in plastic. I mean, you wrap it up so it doesn't come in contact with other things. But you can't really, can't do anything with it. Although a lot of it can be redeemed, the Maser Sheni can be redeemed, the Maser Ani is given to the poor, etc. Okay, now let me go back to this. Now, again, this is by way of just general introduction, but I think it's good to have a little bit of knowledge in this area. Obviously, therefore, it's important to always know what year a fruit or vegetable belongs to. Because if it's a second year fruit or vegetable, the tithe would be Maser Sheni. If it's a third year fruit or vegetable, the tithe would be Maserani. I have to know, if I'm taking off Trumas and Maseros, I need to know what year this produce belongs. Now, here is where life gets a bit complicated. Because if we were to ask us, a layperson, well, what year does this produce belong to? We would simply say, well, whatever year it was harvested is what it belongs to. Not true. There are special definitions for fruits, for vegetables, and for grain. Fruit, vegetable, and grain have three different definitions as to what year they belong to. Let me illustrate this. Grain is allocated to the year that it reached a third of its anticipated growth. By that I mean the following. Let's assume, by years begin on Rosh Hashanah, so let's assume it's the second year of Shemitah, beginning on Rosh Hashanah. Towards the end of that year, the grain reached a third of its growth, but two-thirds of its growth was after Rosh Hashanah, and it was harvested after Rosh Hashanah. So although most of its growth occurred in year three, and it was harvested in year three, halachically it belongs to year two, because that is where it reached a third of its growth. And consequently, the tithe that would be applicable to that grain is the year two tithing. Now, for Truma and Maser Rishon, it makes no difference. That's going to be the same every year. But if the question is, do I take off the Maser Sheni and bring it to Jerusalem? Or do I take off the Maser Ani? The answer is, even though now it's year number three, you take off Maser Sheni because it belongs to year number two. Okay? That's for grain. For vegetables, on the other hand, tomatoes, peppers, lettuce. I look at the year of its harvesting, picking. If it was picked in year number three, even if most of it grew in year number two, and it could have been picked beforehand, it belongs to the year of picking. And if the year of picking is a third year, it's Maser Ani. If the year of picking is the fourth year, it'd be Maser Sheni, etc. So whether you're going from year two to three, or whether you're going from year three to four, you look at the picking year, not the growing year. So that's grain. That's vegetables. What about trees? Fruits. Apples, right? Pears, peaches. So here we have a third definition. And that is, fruits are assigned to the year that they blossomed. Now here, if you know the way a tree typically produces fruits, first there is a flower, right? There's a bud. Year of its blossoming, which means budding. Meaning to say what? That if a tree budded in the old year, even though the fruit was not harvested till the next year, the maser for the fruit is based on the earlier year and not the later year. Now, where Tu B'Shvat comes in is the following. So trees are different, that I look at budding instead of harvesting. But trees are also different because the definition of a year for a tree begins from Tu B'Shvat and not from Rosh. Again, I'll try to explain why, but I just want to understand the what first of all. Meaning the following. For every other thing, for grains and for vegetables, a year runs from Rosh Hashanah to the end of the 29th of Elul. Rosh Hashanah to Rosh Hashanah. Right? A Jewish year is Rosh Hashanah to Rosh Hashanah. A tree year is from Tu B'Shvat to Tu B'Shvat. Right? The fiscal year of trees is a different year. Now you understand the implications. That means, therefore, a tree whose fruit blossomed after Rosh Hashanah but before Tu B'Shvat still belongs to the old year, even though it's harvested after Tu B'Shvat, and even though the blossoming was even after Rosh Hashanah. Because until the new Tu B'Shvat, you're still operating on the old year. Now that is unique to trees. For example, a vegetable that is harvested between a new Rosh Hashanah and a Tu B'Shvat belongs to the new year. Right? Because the vegetable year begins Rosh Hashanah. But for a tree, it's allocated to the old year until Tu B'Shvat. Again, we'll explain why, but I just want you to understand. So when the Mishnah says Tu B'Shvat is Rosh Hashanah le'ilanos, a new year for trees, it is not connoting a festivity, it's not connoting a particular joy, it's simply a very technical halachic concept for the purpose of trumos and masros, to know what year a tree or fruit belongs to for the appropriate tithing. Another reason why this would be significant halachically is because of Orla. Now what is Orla? Orla, again, this is just general knowledge one should know. Orla is a din that when you plant a tree, the fruit that comes out the first 3 years from the planting, whatever fruit comes out the first years from the planting, is not allowed to be eaten, and it must be actually burnt or destroyed. Now the truth is, if you're planting a new sapling, generally speaking, you're not going to have fruit for the first 3 years. So Orla is not much of a problem with real new trees, but where it is a tremendous problem is when you replant existing trees. Sometimes you may replant a tree, etc. And the problem is, even it might be an old tree that's produced a lot of fruit already, but once you replant it, if it's uprooted and replanted, the laws of Orla start all over again for the next 3 years.
You said that when the years from the time the fruit appears.
No. It is from the planting of the tree.
Yeah.
Okay. If your first fruit appears more than 3 years later, you're okay. It's 3 years from the planting.
Now, can you just let the stuff fall to the ground and not eat it that way?
That's a machlokas. It seems, according to the law of the Gemara, you're supposed to actually burn it. But the prevailing custom seems to simply let it rot.
I understand that you can...
By the way, this applies in Chutz La'aretz too, by the way.
It does?
Yeah.
That's the only one of these laws.
This is the only one of those, that and one other, and planting, planting grain next to your vineyard if you had it, but this does apply to Chutz La'aretz, yeah.
Now, I understand as a ruler, even if you don't know what the tree is, or if you're walking along, and assuming that it's a place where you could do this without the owner getting mad, you're allowed to just pick something off a tree and eat it right there. Not a bunch, but just take one without worrying about all these things.
No, that's absolutely not the case. Who told you that? That would be stealing.
I'm saying, assuming that it was a place where maybe it was a natural tree, wasn't owned by anybody, you know what I mean?
Okay.
And you could walk by, even if you're not sure whether what year it's in, you could take one of them off the tree, eat it immediately, not taking it with you.
Well, I'm not sure what halacha you're referring to. I mean, the Torah says, for example, workers who are harvesting in a field are permitted to eat while they're working. And if something is ownerless, I'm allowed to pick it off the tree and eat it, but then I don't have to wait till I get home. In other words, Yuvanashach, if something is truly hefker, I'm allowed to take it and take it home. I don't have to eat it while I'm walking. So I'm not sure what halacha you're referring to there.
I know that in Israel is a law that you can do that, that everything is pretty much hefker. All the trees can do that.
Well, that may be so, but if something is hefker, you don't have to only eat it while you're there. Hefker things you can take home and eat it. Yeah, that would be the same thing. But I want to emphasize that hefker takes off the need for truma and maser. And so hefker takes off truma and maser problems. So if you pick a fruit off a hefker tree, you don't have to take off any truma or maser. But hefker does not take off all the problems. So theoretically, if it's within 3 years of the tree being planted, it would still be prohibited. But you can assume that it isn't, generally speaking, for that reason. Okay? Now, the thing about this 3 years, though, this is another case where Tu B'Shvat comes in, is that it doesn't really mean 3 full years. Because we paskin that 1 month can be enough. Let's say, for example, I plant a tree, Elul. Elul is 1 month before Rosh Hashanah. So when Rosh Hashanah comes, that is treated as year one. I have completed year one by having my tree 1 month in a year. So year one is Elul to Rosh Hashanah. Only 1 month, but it counts as year one. Year two is Rosh Hashanah to Rosh Hashanah. Year three will be Rosh Hashanah to Rosh Hashanah. So my 3 years are actually up 2 years and 1 month, you see? But then the Gemara says, but since after 3 years a sapling has now become a tree, for trees, the year now becomes redefined as ending in Tu B'Shvat. And therefore, the halacha therefore is that when it's a sapling, the year is Rosh Hashanah. But when the Orla period is over, it's kind of a catch-22. The Orla period is over, it's now a tree, but since it's a tree, the year is not over until Tu B'Shvat, so the third year is actually a year and a half. In other words, the third year, and right, year number one is Elul to Rosh Hashanah. That's year one. You planted it in Elul. Year two is Rosh Hashanah to Rosh Hashanah. Year three now becomes Rosh Hashanah till next Rosh Hashanah, and then 6 extra months to Tu B'Shvat. Because once it leaves sapling and halachically becomes tree, the year of Orla does not end until Tu B'Shvat. So, Tu B'Shvat in the Mishnah is important for two reasons. One reason is it determines the year for purposes of which maser do you take from fruit. And the second reason why it's important is it determines the expiration of the Orla period. Okay? Those are not festive reasons, right? That wouldn't be a reason to make it a Yom Tov for a day of Simcha. It's just a technical halacha that a farmer needs to know, and a base they need to know, for purposes of Trumas and Masras. And in that sense, Tu B'Shvat is halachically very important. It's extremely important for Orla and for other computations. And yet we do find already, in the time of Chazal, not the time of Chazal, but we do find in the time of the Gaonim were the great rabbinic authorities after the Gemara,
that Tu B'Shvat was invested with a semi-festive character. So in the writings of the Gaonim, we read that we do not recite
and fill the land, v'kiv shuha, and conquer it, dominate it. Their argument is the following. If God, or at least if the Jewish belief is, that God gave the human being power and authority to conquer, to control, to dominate, then that is giving mankind the message, you don't have to live in accordance with the earth, but you can subjugate it, you can despoil it, you can do to it whatever you want to do, because all of it was given to your power. So there are people in the environmentalist movement that argue that this notion of conquering the earth instead of learning to live with the resources of the earth in togetherness has been responsible for the despoiling of the environment. It's a very interesting thing. So one could even say there is a trace of anti-Semitism even in some of the rhetoric of the environmentalist movement. I was going to say, now the mistake with that reasoning is that even if it says in Perek Aleph that the mission of Adam and Chava, or Adam in particular, is kifshua, conquest, control, and domination, but you also have to look at Perek Beis. There are actually two missions. If Perek Aleph gives man the mission of domination and control, in Perek Beis there's a different mission. It says that Hashem put them in Gan Eden li'avda, to cultivate the garden, u'lashamra, and to protect and preserve the garden. So if you only looked at chapter 1, you would see this mission of conquest, domination, and control. But if you also consider chapter 2, you see that there's the concept of preserving and protecting. And therefore, indeed, if the Judeo-Christian ethic can be held at fault for the destruction of the environment, it would only be because people sometimes only read Perek Aleph without ever going to Perek Beis.
What is Perek Aleph?
Well, the answer is, what Perek Aleph says is that the world is indeed given over to the control of mankind, but mankind must behave in a responsible way so it doesn't get destroyed. In other words, well, this is an interesting point. You know, ecology is the study of protecting the environment and everything else. And there is, in the environmental movement, what is called high ecology and what is called low ecology. High ecology is almost a form of Avodah Zarah. High ecology considers the earth and the animals to have some type of sanctity, some type of holiness. And the extreme high ecologists are the animal liberationist movement that says an animal or a human being is no better than an animal, and who gives human beings the right to do anything to animals. And consequently, a high ecologist denies the whole concept of man being made in the image of God. They say it's not true. They say a human being is no better than an animal, and indeed most of them feel animals are much better than human beings. So clearly, the Torah rejects that, because the Torah says, no, God gave the earth and God gave the world to Adam to control and to dominate and to use for human purposes. We cannot deny that. Adam is the pinnacle of creation. Only Adam is in the image of God. Nothing else is in the image of God. But that power must be balanced with the responsibility of taking care of things. So I'll give you an example. We know that you're not allowed to hurt animals. Causing pain to animals is an aveira, tsar balichayim, right? We know it's tsar balichayim. However, it's not because animals are as important as human beings. Rather, by virtue of our superior position, we are obligated to treat animals with kindness and compassion. So it's a very, very different rhetoric. So an animal liberationist would say it is immoral to use animals for experimentation to find cancer cures, even if that could save human life. That is immoral, that is a crime. Judaism would say, if that is the only way we could test the cancer drug, it would be a crime not to. Now,
That's not to say that when you're testing animals in painful ways to see that a better deodorant or a better perfume and the animals get blinded, that might indeed be very much us. Because to bring pain on animals for trivial benefits that human beings could very well live without, that would indeed be forbidden under Torah law. Okay, we're very, very makbid on Tsar Bali Chayim. However, to say that even to save a human life, this wouldn't be permitted, that would be elevating animals over humans, and that would be high ecology. See, low ecology is simply much more pragmatic. Low ecology says we need to protect the environment because we need to take care of God's world in a responsible way. We're not elevating the animal or the plant over the human being. They even have a word. High ecologists call it speciesism. Speciesism is the discrimination in favor of the human species over plants and animal species. In fact, there are many, I don't know how they dress, there are many that even take this idea of not killing other forms of life to include plants. I'm just not sure, that's very extreme fringe. I mean, there are people who will not wear wool, they will not wear leather, okay, I understand that. But still, they wear cotton, right? Cotton comes from a plant. So there's others that say, well, you can't even kill plants. So I'm not sure what they wear. You wear rocks. I'm not sure what the...
Exactly.
Ran. Okay. We're back to artificial stuff. Paper. Yeah. Put them from trees. Yes. 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 That's right. And it's very, very interesting that the animal liberationist movement, which is really very much out to free imprisoned animals and the like, is a very, very violent movement. Many, many people have died. And, you know, they've bombed buildings and they've exploded things. So in the interest of saving the animals, many people have died. And what's interesting is that Peter Singer, Jewish guy, is an Australian philosopher who is the spiritual, or not spiritual, but he's the philosophical head of the animal liberationist movement. He wrote a book on it, and his book is The Bible of the Movement. Well, Peter Singer wrote two books that I know of. One book talks about the notion of equal rights for animals. And the other book he writes about is a case for the euthanasia of newborn babies who are mentally or physically handicapped. And he advocates killing children who are not fully in good condition. So it's very, very interesting that on one hand, animal liberation, which seems to be the call for mercy, for compassion, for concern for all of God's creatures, then becomes a call for euthanasia of kids who have Down syndrome. And you might say, it's kind of a paradox here. How can the same guy who is animal liberation be the same guy that is calling for killing newborn babies? We're not even talking about abortion here. We're not talking about abortion. His book is not about abortion. His book is about infanticide, killing the baby. The answer is this. When you make human beings equivalent to animals, then what you're saying is human beings are only animals. If they are only animals, the same way we would take a dog out of his misery. And that's legitimate, right? Dog is suffering. Put the dog to sleep. That's a humane thing to do. There is a concept, why not put human beings to sleep? So animal liberation does not elevate animals to the state of man. It rather denigrates mankind to the level of animals. And that's why we find, and this is really what Chazal says, Chazal have a statement, he who has mercy, when it's inappropriate to have mercy, will have cruelty when it's inappropriate to have cruelty, meaning excessive mercy in one area will tend to turn into cruelty. And that's why, you know, again, I'm not saying this is the cause, but it's no accident that Hitler was a vegetarian. It is said out of his great reverence for life. Now, he did not believe in taking animal life. But a person who killed 6 million Jews and about 1.5 million other people had a great reverence for life. Now, what does that mean? Again, we'll come back, we have a lot more to talk about, but what does this mean in terms of being a vegetarian? So it means the following. If a person says, I want to be a vegetarian because I think eating meat is not healthy, that's a perfectly legitimate statement for a person to make. There are questions about Shabbos and Yom Tov, etc., and one could talk about, but the truth of the matter is, certainly on Shabbos, Yom Tov is more of a problem a little bit, but certainly on Shabbos, one is not obligated to eat meat if they don't want to eat meat. It's not a pleasure for them. So if one says, I'm a vegetarian because it's a healthier lifestyle, because of the hate, that's fine. If one says, I'm a vegetarian because I want to protest the inhumane way that animals are kept before they are slaughtered, such as the penning up of veal, you know, calves, who are not allowed to move,